The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
Hey, it's Will Friedle.
And Sabrina Bryan.
And we're the hosts of the new podcast, Magical Rewind.
You may know us from some of your favorite childhood TV movies, like My Date with the President's Daughter.
And the Cheetah Girls movies.
Together, we're sitting down to watch all the movies you grew up with and chat with some of your favorite stars and crew that made these iconic movies happen.
So kick back, grab your popcorn, and join us. Listen to Magical Rewind on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
I'm Sam Edis.
And I'm Amy Nelson. Welcome to What's Her Story with Sam and Amy.
This is a show about the world's most remarkable women, their professional and personal journeys.
Together, we'll hear from gold medalists, best-selling authors, and leaders of the world's most iconic brands.
Listen every Thursday or join the conversation anytime on Instagram at What's Her Story Podcast.
Eva Galperin has been referred to as a hacker hero. She is the director of cybersecurity at the Electronic Frontier Foundation and technical advisor for the Freedom of the Press Foundation. She is the co-founder of Stop Stalkerware. So Eva, how did you become interested in privacy, in free speech, in this entire world?
I am an immigrant who came to the United States as a child with my family from the Soviet Union. And so all of my most sort of foundational memories are built around this notion that we left a place with no civil liberties to come to a place that had more of them, and that the protection of those liberties was very important. Life in the Soviet Union was always framed as, you know, this place where you had no privacy and where you had no free speech. And that these were extremely important values that that we needed to protect. And so I guess I really internalized that growing up.
And then your interest in technology really started very early on. Tell us about that.
We left the Soviet Union and then we landed in Silicon Valley in the 80s. My mom was a geneticist, and so she came to, you know, San Francisco and worked in biotech. And my dad was an engineer, and so he came to Silicon Valley and worked at a series of tech companies. And as a result, there was always tech around the house. And I was online at a time when most children were not, when there was an internet, but there was no web. And it was assumed that if you were able to speak to other people over this internet, that you were at least in college and probably using like your first college account. And in my case, that is not what I was doing. I was actually using a 2400 baud modem and one of those little VT100 green screens that you used to see in libraries to place a phone call to my dad's desktop machine at Sun Microsystems in order to contact the rest of the internet. And so my first experiences online all required me to sort of have a strong understanding of how the internet worked. And that brought me, you know, a lot of the fundamentals that helped me land my first jobs.
But how did you sit down in front of that first computer?
So one of my friends had found some sort of like chat group on Prodigy relating to, you know, our favorite, you know, fantasy and science fiction series. And I came to my father and I said, "Daddy, Daddy, can I get Prodigy so that I can, you know, sit around talking about dragons?" And my father said, "No, daughter. Prodigy sucks." And he got me a shell account on his computer and showed me how to use newsgroups and Usenet.
So take us to your first job.
I guess my first computer job was during my freshman year in college at UCSC. I worked for a company in Sunnyvale doing sort of a desktop administration of Windows machines and also a bunch of, you know, Unix administration on a lot of Solaris machines and some network administration. And the reason that I was able to do this was because I had seen all of these things before and I had spent a bunch of time, you know, building my own computers, and I already understood how networks worked. And so all I had to do was just sort of expand that knowledge out into, you know, how do you look after many machines at once instead of just the one machine that you have in your house. And that turned out to be such a useful skill that eventually I was like, wait a minute, what am I going to college for again? And I dropped out.
Some people have called you their hacker hero. How did you go from where you were then to becoming the cyber hacking superstar that you are today?
Well, I don't want to leave people with the impression that it is just a nonstop rise to power where, you know, I as a wunderkind mastered the internet. No, none of that is true. I dropped out of school in order to go work a steady tech job, and my parents were appalled, and they were like, "But you need to go to college." And so I told them, "Oh, don't worry. When this bubble bursts, I will go back to school." And I was lying, but the bubble did burst. Because I have lived in Silicon Valley for a very long time, and I have seen many bubbles come and go. So the bubble did burst, and no one I knew had a job in the early 2000s. And certainly I did not have a job. And I turned around and I went back to school. I got a degree in international relations and political science. I spent 2 years studying Chinese. And my intention was to go to law school next and become a lawyer. I'm like, well, you know, this computer stuff really isn't working out. And I was just about to go to law school and gotten into law school. And the guy that I was dating at the time said, "You know, I don't want to leave the Bay Area. The law schools that you got into are far away. So I've just started a job at this place called Twitter, and I think it might go somewhere. So can you just like give me a year? Just go get a job somewhere and give me a year while we work all of this stuff out." And he went to go work for Twitter, and I went to go work for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And my job was, you know, extremely high-powered and technical. It was my job to answer the phone. I answered the phone at EFF in 2007, which was shortly after the Civil Liberties Organization had filed a lawsuit against AT&T for its part in the NSA's warrantless wiretapping program that had been going on since 2003. This was a Bush-era program. And that meant that we had a lot of people contacting us who were concerned about government surveillance. And some of those people had really interesting cases. And some of those people were in need of a therapist. And it was my job to tell the difference between these two kinds of people and to very patiently sort of corral both of them. And that was something that I did for several years. And it really gave me a strong background in all of EFF's different issues. I learned about copyright. I got to apply my international relations skills. I got to apply my my language skills and also my technical skills when it came to, you know, sort of understanding how this kind of surveillance worked. This was also the height of the MPAA and the RIAA's efforts to sue mostly college students for pirating movies and music. And so I was also hearing from a lot of people who were only a couple years younger than I was, who had these, you know, terrifying letters that were coming from the RIAA and the NPAA saying, you know, give us thousands of dollars or we will sue you into oblivion because you downloaded a movie once or you downloaded an album. And so I spent some time working on that as well. There was actually a really interesting thing that happened while I was doing this job, which was there was a law firm that came up with this interesting scam where they would upload files to the internet purporting to be various types of porn, and then they would see who downloaded it. And then they would send threatening letters to that person saying, we know you downloaded this porn, and unless you want us to sue you, a lawsuit in which the title of this porn, allowing people to know embarrassing things about your taste in pornography, unless you want us to file this lawsuit, please give us $2,000. And they sent out thousands and thousands of these letters. It was a tremendous scam. So those were my first experiences dealing with people who were being unfairly surveilled, unfairly targeted, with vulnerable populations, with people who were really scared and feeling powerless and were having their worst day and would then reach out to me.
Were you comfortable, or how did you go about taking that role of answering phones into really analyzing what was coming through in these massive early issues with the internet?
Well, part of it was just the act of repetition. Once you've seen, you know, several hundred different examples of the same issue, you get really good at triaging it very fast. And when you have accurately triaged things for, you know, for your legal team or for your activism team, you know, consistently for the better part of, you know, a year or two or three, then your peers start to trust your judgment. And you kind of build up that kind of rapport. But really, it just came from doing it over and over and over again until I got very good at it. The work of answering the phones at the Electronic Frontier Foundation had, prior to me, been a job that famously burned people out. It was very rare for somebody last more than a year doing that.
Why weren't you burned out by that job?
I think I just had a, you know, tech startup kids capacity for burnout. I had a very different idea about what qualified as burnout. And I'm not going to tell you that that was healthy. It absolutely was not. I think the one of the things that's really changed at EFF, and in fact, in just in workplaces in general, in the many years that have gone by since I did that job, is that we have a lot more understanding of the psychological impacts of doing this kind of work, and an understanding that you can't expect people to deal with other people's trauma 24/7 every single day.
And now, a quick break.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
We went from normal life, healthy child, to acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
Eva, there was an incident at your work that led you to really focus on cyber stalking.
I spent many years focused on the privacy and security needs of activists and journalists, largely in North Africa and the Middle East. A lot of this was happening during the Arab Spring and sort of the years after the Arab Spring. But in late 2017, early 2018, it became known that my primary collaborator on all of the security research that I was doing was a serial rapist. He had been running around raping women for decades. And in January, I think, of 2018, an interview came out with one of his survivors. And she was just terrified. She was really, really scared. And everybody else in that article was really scared. And they were scared of him, not just because he had been, you know, raping women for several decades, but also because he was a hacker. And they were afraid that he was going to compromise their devices. So they all had their, you know, their microphones covered, and they all had their cameras covered, and they were terrified. And I was so mad. I got so mad. And I didn't want anybody to ever feel that way again. And as a result, I started a project that was aimed at the sort of commercial spyware that these kinds of abusers use in order to stalk their victims. And I co-founded an organization called the Coalition Against Stalkerware, and we've been working on this issue ever since.
Can you give an example to our listeners as to how it all works and what it means to be cyberstalked?
Well, there are many different forms of electronic surveillance or stalking, but the particular thing that I chose to focus on, because it's so invasive and also very easy to do, is stalkerware. So there is commercially available software that anyone can find or purchase, that if they have physical access to your device and they have like your username and password, which is an extremely common combination of things when you're dealing with somebody who is abusing you, what the abuser does is they simply grab the other person's phone when they're not looking, download the stalkerware onto their phone, and then the phone covertly exfiltrates data from the phone, usually to a website which is run by the company that makes the stalkerware. And then the abuser pays a monthly fee to the stalkerware company in order to get that get access to that data through a portal.
You have been vocal about trying to come after the executives from the stalkerware companies, because presumably this is one of the worst possible ways to be making money in this world. Have you been successful at that?
I have had some success when it comes to going after the stalkerware companies themselves. I am very careful about how I do this, because I am myself a security researcher. And so I want to be really careful not to use any of the tools that are used to sort of persecute security researchers for doing our thing, even against bad people. And I want to make sure that I don't create any bad precedent that can then be used to stop the kind of work that I do. But in addition to the fact that stalkerware is very bad, it is often very poorly made. It's often really insecure. So not only is your data available to your stalker, but sometimes these portals leave data open for anybody to see. And I have managed to convince the FTC to take action against two such companies that ended up behaving in this way.
You've gone up against some really powerful companies and powerful people. Have you ever felt afraid? Have you faced any backlash?
Before I worked on domestic abuse, I was working to support people who were being stalked by authoritarian governments. And if you think an abusive partner is a jerk, wait until you are, say, going up against the Syrian government in 2012. It's a very different kind of situation. And I have been targeted before by a government that was angry about my activism. The Vietnamese government actually sent me malware. But I'm not scared because this sort of stuff is old hat to me. I have been doing it for a very long time. And it's just very difficult to frighten me at this point, which means that I don't get bullied a lot.
What is your relationship to personal safety like in your own everyday life, not online?
Well, a lot of people are surprised. They say, well, you know, I can find you online. You're using your real name. There are pictures of you. I can see them. You know, I know what city you live in and all that sort of thing. You use social media. I see that you have like an Instagram account and a Facebook account and whatever. And they say, well, how dare you? You know, you're a privacy and security activist. How can you be doing this? And the answer is that privacy and security are not about living on a mountaintop, throwing all of your devices into the ocean, which is presumably located near this mountaintop. It is about having control over your data and making decisions about who you do and do not share it with. And so my life is locked down, but it's not so locked down that I can't move. I think one of the most important things that we really lose sight of when we talk about privacy and security online is that you need some wiggle room. You can't just turn around and leave the internet. And that's advice that people give to survivors of domestic abuse all the time. They're like, you're being harassed, you're being followed, you're being stalked, just don't use the internet. Just, you know, shut down all of your social media accounts and never talk to your friends again. And that's just more alienating.
What about when you're just in your everyday life? Do you find that you're less trusting of people given your work?
I'm not sure what I would use as a benchmark. I was never a particularly trusting person.
What is your personal life like when letting a new relationship into your life? Are you more cautious than the average person?
I don't know. I don't have an average person around to compare myself with. I limit the kind of risks that I take, but I also, you know, I live in reality where you have to be able to communicate with other people and have them be able to find you on occasion. I don't live like a secret agent.
Okay, so when you met your partner, did you meet online or no?
No.
So you've never dated online?
No, I still meet people the old-fashioned way, where you in meet space. I do not have any good advice for trying to date online in the year of our Lord 2022. That seems terrifying.
What is your relationship like with your parents today?
Really nice, actually. I mean, I did, in my mid-20s, apologize to my parents for that the entire time I was a teenager. And now we get along just fine. But I was an exceptionally difficult teenager.
How would you define sort of the biggest mistakes that most people are making when it comes to exposing their own online world to potential stalkers or bad people?
Well, I think that the first thing people really need to think about is what we call threat modeling. So you need to sit down and you need to think about what you want to protect and who you want to protect it from. Because trying to protect everything from everybody all at once is a good way to go insane. It's just not practical. The other thing to keep in mind is that the people that you trust today are not necessarily going to be the same people that you trust tomorrow. Abusers, for example, do not show up with a great big sign across their forehead saying, "Hello, I'm an abuser." They show up looking like the best thing that's ever happened to you. And I think that it's really important for people to understand the dynamics of abuse, but also to understand how to lock someone out of their lives, how to sort of take back all of the permissions that they have given, and how to do it decisively and quickly. And to sort of practice these skills in advance, because generally when you need to lock somebody out of your life, you are already in a heightened state of panic. And that's not when you want to be practicing tricky new skills.
Now, a lot of people feel like if a partner is not allowing you to hold their phone and use their phone and know their password, that they're hiding something. that's sort of the converse to, you know, being protective. What do you think about, I mean, does your partner have access to your phone?
Oh, hell no.
Okay. Will they ever?
No. Not their phone.
So in 20 years, he would never be able to just use your phone to look up something on the internet.
Is his phone broken? Did something happen to his fingers?
What if you're going on a road trip and he forgot his phone?
We would turn around and go get it.
Okay. So there is no circumstance under which he can use your phone.
I mean, in some sort of situation where, like, terrorists are going to destroy the world unless I hand him my phone, sure. But for the most part, you know, no, I have my own devices. I have my own privacy. And there's no reason I would ever have to give access to that stuff to another person. If I want someone to have access to one of my devices, I will set up a separate account for them that they can log into in order to get to that device. And the same thing happens with, you know, all of the electronics around the house. You want access, you can have an account. And when it's time for you to go, I can change the password on that account. I can lock that account out. I can delete that account. But you don't get mine.
And now, a quick break.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
We went from normal life, healthy child, to acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
In 2020, you gave a TED Talk that, you know, has over 3 million views. How did that change the trajectory of your career?
I was actually kind of surprised. I was approached by TED to give a talk, and they sort of shrugged when I asked them what I should talk about. Like, they didn't care. They just wanted me to get up on stage and say stuff. And I was like, okay. All right, fine. I'll just talk about this thing that I'm currently working on. And I didn't expect for it to strike such a nerve. But I think it was really just the combination of the technical problem that I was working on, combined with the kind of human interest story of all of these people who are being targeted, combined with the human interest story of I got so mad I decided to destroy an industry.
What are you working on today?
Well, right now, I have just spent a bunch of time working on physical trackers, so like tiles and air tags. I am not destroying the industry. I'm trying to get the industry to agree on a standard that they will then publish so that the people who make phones and other devices can build sort of tracker detection directly into those devices that will work all the time in the background. So you don't have to like specifically download an app for every single different type of tracker and then run a scan for every single kind of tracker, because that is a hellscape. And that's sort of where we are now. The other thing that I'm working on right now is privacy and safety for people who are seeking abortions and who are doing abortion support. That's definitely been my last couple of months of work. and trying to come up with best practices for people, and also really bringing these issues up to people who are working in tech, who are making products and who are making platforms, and get them to think about how they are going to protect users who are traveling to abortion clinics or searching for information about abortions, or who are simply being prosecuted for their pregnancy outcome, whether it was an abortion or a miscarriage. And a lot of the danger to people in these populations isn't widespread now, but I have spent a lot of time working in authoritarian countries and watching laws get passed very quickly and watching the entire threat landscape change very quickly. And when you build a platform or you build a tool, it's really hard to turn that ship around fast. So I want them to start turning it around now before it becomes necessary.
You've said that you were a difficult teenager. If Eva was a teenager today, her parents would have Life 360 and be tracking her every move, how fast the vehicles she's driving in are going. What are your thoughts on all of these parental tracking devices that are now sort of the norm?
Hilariously, my parents wouldn't. My parents gave me a tremendous amount of freedom, partially out of respect for my need to go figure out who I was and what I was doing. And that caused them a great deal of anxiety. But they did it. And part of that, I think, is because kids now grow up in a much more heavily surveilled environment than I did. I grew up during an era of latchkey kids, where it was totally normal for, you know, kids to come home from school, let themselves into the house, microwave up some ramen, possibly feed their younger sibling, and then somewhere around 8 or 9, a very tired parent comes home. That's not what parenting is like now. It's very different. So I think that sort of comparison is just sort of unfair. As for parenting apps, I think that parents should give their kids some room to grow and some slack. But at the same time, if you are going to watch your kids and what they're doing online and what they're doing on their various devices, there are two bits of advice that I have. The first is, don't lie to them. Don't lie to them. Don't fool them. Make sure that they understand, you know, exactly, here are the tools that I am using, here is the information that they get. And the second is to talk to your kids about being responsible online and how to look out for threats themselves and make sure that they're comfortable coming to you with problems. Like, do some parenting. I think that there is a sort of authoritarian bent in parenting right now. This kind of idea that you have to run your house like a police state. And you don't. If you think you gotta fool your kids, there are other solutions which seem like they would probably be less harmful in the long run.
Sam, do you want to go to the speed round?
Yeah.
What book are you reading right now?
Right now, I am reading a book called Braiding Sweetgrass, which is about combining notions about science and environmentalism with the author's experience as a Native American growing up in the United States.
What is your morning routine?
I wake up in the morning and I have first coffee. No mental effort happens before first coffee. And then I just sort of stagger until I manage second coffee. I'm not a very good morning person.
Who leaves you starstruck?
Probably the last time that I felt that way was EFF gave a Pioneer Award to William Gibson. And I stood in the same room as the guy who wrote all of the science fiction that really influenced a whole lot of my early childhood. And I was extraordinarily impressed. But mostly I was impressed not only that he wrote all of these books that influenced me very much at an early age, but that he is writing books now that I feel are very much at the top of his game. Because what he does with science fiction is what any good writer does, which is that people think you're describing the future, but all you're really doing is describing the present with a really discerning eye. And so he is an amazing observer of the present.
You're clearly very fearless. What is your greatest fear?
I've tackled so many of my fears by just sort of throwing myself into them. There are people who are afraid of public speaking, so I took up competitive public speaking in college. There are people who are afraid of heights. I am a circus aerialist. I do tricks 30 feet up in the air upside down and spinning until I am not afraid of heights anymore. But there are definitely still things that I am afraid of. And I think that more than anything, what I dread is losing autonomy. I have a tremendous amount of autonomy in my day-to-day life, more than I ever thought that it was possible for a person to have. And losing that would be, I think, a really big blow.
You know, years ago, I did a book series called The Expert's Guides, right, to different things. And I would always try to find the top expert in every field. And certainly, I would have approached Eva for, you know, a how to protect yourself online chapter. But I admire anyone who gets to the top of the field like she has.
I completely agree. And I think with Eva, the thing that's even more interesting is she is a woman who has really taken truth to power in a completely male-dominated arena, right? All of those things together, like, that's really hard. And in the national security arena, which, like, in and of itself is an intimidating place to be.
I thought the most surprising thing was how little fear she has about her own safety and how little concern she has for that. It really surprised me. I felt like she was going to at least be a little guarded about that or have some just practical concern, but it almost makes you feel more powerful, the fact that she's not afraid at all.
Absolutely. Thanks for listening to What's Her Story with Sam and Amy.
We would appreciate it if you'd leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, connect with us on social media at What's Her Story Podcast.
What's Her Story with Sam and Amy is powered by my company, The Riveter, at theriveter.co, and Sam's company, Park Place Payments, at parkplacepayments.com.
Thanks to our producer, Stacey Para, and our male perspective, Lou Burns.